Hi, I'm Caitlin Van Maul, host of I Survived. If you enjoy I Survived, we are excited to announce a new launch. Starting November 15th, we'll be reposting our classic episodes from season one of I Survived. We hope to reach a whole new audience with these important stories of survival. And for those of you who have been with us since the beginning, we think these powerful episodes warrant another listen. Starting November 15th, look out for those episodes and more news from I Survived.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 243 of the True Crime All the Time Unsolved podcast. I'm Mike Ferguson, and with me, as always, is my partner in true crime, Mike Gibson. Gibby, how are you?
I'm doing good, man. How about you?
I'm doing real well.
Good.
You and I just finished up recording a brand new Patreon episode.
We did.
On both video and audio. It's Patreon episode number 40.
Yeah.
Kind of hard to believe we put that many of those out.
Well, we also put out a lot of these, too. So,
well, that's true. We put out a lot of stuff. But 40 of those. So there's a lot of stuff on Patreon. If you're not a Patreon supporter, now's a great time to sign up. Check it out.
Yeah, we got a big year coming up for Patreon. So it's a good time to get aboard.
Yeah, it is. We have some new ideas that we're working on for 2022.
Exactly.
It's going to be hard to say. Speaking of Patreon, let's give our shout outs. We had Julie.
Hey, Julie.
Sarah.
What's going on, Sarah?
Britannia Walker.
What up, Britannia?
Holly Levitt.
Hey, Holly.
Mark Lemons.
Hey, appreciate that, Mark.
Tristan Fisher.
Well, thank you, Tristan.
Jennifer Jolly.
What's up, JJ?
Crystal Adams.
Hey, Crystal.
Sindel Morris.
What's going on, Sindel?
Jenna.
Good old Jenna.
Angela Bissett.
Very famous Angela, you know.
Hannah Abshire.
Hey, Hannah.
Sav.
What's up, Sav?
Stefania Sweet.
SS.
Tanner.
What's going on, Tanner?
Aubrey Wood.
Hey, Aubrey.
Danita Key.
Appreciate that, Danita.
Teresa Fayo.
Hey, what's going on, Fayo?
And Beth Marinovich.
Hey, Marinovich.
So that's a lot of great new support gives. We really appreciate it.
We do.
We have no vault this week because we have no TCAT.
No.
So we only do the vault when we have both episodes out.
Yeah.
I don't want to shortchange anybody on the vault. They may listen to one and not the other. So we only do it when we have episodes on both.
Well, they've been in the vault long enough. So it's not another week or two is not going to hurt them.
It's not going to hurt them. They're still in there. I mentioned that we just put out a Patreon episode last night. It's on Matthew Cheltbate.
Yeah.
It's an interesting case about, you know, pretty young person. He was 21.
Right.
Kind of brought in an 18-year-old into kind of this group. They were into some shady stuff.
Yeah.
And essentially they used this kid, James, for what he had, his car, his bank account. And then when they were done with him, Matthew killed him.
Yeah. It's a good case.
It is. Yeah, it is. It's got some interesting facets to it. All right, buddy. Are you ready to get into this episode of True Crime All the Time Unsolved?
And I am ready.
We are talking about the Edgecombe County serial killer. We're headed to North Carolina. From 2003 to 2009, 10 women and one man, all African American, in their late 20s to their early 50s, disappeared from the Edgecombe County area of North Carolina. They were Denise Williams, Melody Wiggins, Travis Harrison, Christine Boone, Jackie Thorpe, Ernestine Battle, Yolanda Lancaster, Elizabeth Smallwood, Tara Nicholson, Jarnice Hargrove, and Roberta Williams. That's a lot of people.
That's a lot.
To go missing from, you know, essentially this area in a 6-year span.
Yeah. Definitely raise some eyebrows.
One by one, the bodies were found, mostly along Seven Bridges Road in Edgecombe County. This led the mystery killer to be called the Edgecombe County Serial Killer. You'll also see this case referred as the Seven Bridges Serial Killer after the 13-mile stretch and the surrounding area where he dumped some of his victims' bodies.
And we've covered many unsolved and solved cases where the serial killer had two, three, even four names sometimes.
Yeah, the media likes to get a little creative. We know that with naming conventions of serial killers, of killers. The Edgecombe County serial killer's victims generally came from similar backgrounds and were living under similar circumstances at the time of their disappearances. Most of them had had run-ins with the law, were sex workers, and had a history of drug dependency. Many of the victims had been stabbed, beaten, or strangled before the killer dumped their bodies. However, the cause of death couldn't be identified for three of the victims. A possible 12th victim, Joyce Durham, is believed to have been murdered by the Edgecombe killer as well. However, her body has never been found. In 2009, DNA helped law enforcement find a suspect linked to one of the victims. The investigators had hoped to connect the suspect to the rest of the murder victims. The suspect in question was eventually convicted of the murder of Tara Nicholson. Unfortunately for prosecutors and the remaining victims' families, investigators have been unable to charge the suspect with any of the other murders to date. So, you know, there's a big question here, Gibbs, in this case.
Sure.
This suspect was convicted of one murder. So naturally, people are going to ask the question, is this person the Edgecombe County serial killer? Is he responsible for the murder of the other victims? Now, this guy has never confessed.
No.
And as far as we know, investigators don't have any evidence linking him to the other murders. I think at the very least, they don't have the evidence required to charge him with other murders. I think that's safe to say.
Yeah. I mean, I think the good thing is, if you want to find the silver lining, you know, he's not going anywhere anytime soon. So they can continue to at least work on the case and maybe one day bring charges against him.
All right. So let's get into the details. On June 2nd, 2003, a fisherman found the body of 21-year-old Denise Williams floating in Cokies Creek, just outside the city of Rocky Mount in Northeast North Carolina.
We're a little familiar with Rocky Mount, aren't we?
Yep.
Yeah, we used to do a little business there.
Denise, who was a mother of two, was last seen a week earlier after dropping off a friend at home. Denise's family was heartbroken. According to the Rocky Mount Telegram, she'd had a bright future. She was using her natural computer skills to work towards a telecommunications career. Then on May 29th, 2005, the body of a 29-year-old mother of two, Melody Lachey Wiggins, was found on Nobles Mill Pond Road in Edgecombe County. She was partially nude and had been fatally stabbed several times. Melody had also sustained blows to her head, resulting in blunt force trauma. She'd been in a violent relationship, earned income from sex work, and had some contact with law enforcement before she died. According to the Rocky Mount Telegram, Melody's boyfriend reported her missing on June 2nd, saying that he'd last seen her in Rocky Mount on her way to a friend's house. Her body had been found days earlier. So I think based on that, Gibbs, police were a little suspicious of the boyfriend's account. But police found out that at the time of Melody's murder in late May, her boyfriend had an alibi. He had been in custody.
It's about as good as alibi as you can get.
Yeah, it's actually a pretty good one. I mean, the records are there.
Yeah.
Unlike in some other countries that, you know, we've talked about on different episodes, a little rare to get, you know, let's say a weekend pass or And they would have known that if sure. it would have happened anyway. It's a much better alibi than many that we talk about. You know, a mom stands up and says, yes, my son was with me all night. A girlfriend does that. You know, the old time card punch.
Oh, yeah.
Alibi has come up in some sure. cases. And we know those can be faked, or you could have a coworker do that for you.
But the old Officer Smith at the jailhouse, he knows I was here on that night. Much better.
A year later, on June 25th, 2006, the body of 24-year-old Travis Rarigis Harrison was found amongst the undergrowth near the Tar River. Travis was known to cross-dress and engage in sex work to support a drug habit. He was clad only in socks when his body was found not far from his home, where he lived with his family. But his body was so badly decomposed that his cause of death was unable to be determined.
These victims are stacking up.
Well, we mentioned it, right? It's a big number in a 6-year period of time. Yeah. You know, to have 11, possibly 12 victims of a single killer, if it was a single killer, that's a lot.
It is. And it's got to be somewhat scary for the public, right? As this information leaks out.
Yeah, I think it always is to find out that so many people, many of whom have a somewhat similar background mm-hmm. or, you know, are engaged in similar activities, are being found murdered. Okay, that community is obviously going to be on edge.
Sure.
Because they're engaged in, you know, let's say the same line of work. But the general public is on edge as well, because you never know. You know, is this a killer who is only targeting a certain segment of the population? Or at any time, could they begin randomly selecting their victims? All of that is scary.
Sure is.
About 7 months later, on January 16th, 2007. 43-year-old Christine Marie Boone was reported missing. She was one of 10 children, and later in life, Christine developed a crack habit as an adult. Her sister, who reported her missing, later described Christine as a loving and caring person who got caught up with the wrong crowd. Her 3 children and 7 grandchildren waited for news, but none came. To her grieving family, it didn't seem as though police were that invested in finding out what had happened to her. So, you know, there's a couple of things here that I want to flush out.
Sure.
A little bit. The first one is a loving and caring person who kind of gets caught up with the wrong crowd, gets, let's say, hooked on drugs.
Right.
And that obviously changes the course of their life. We hear that from a lot of family members.
Yeah.
And I do think it happens to quite a few people.
Well, you just covered that on the Patreon-only episode.
Yeah.
Getting yeah. involved with the wrong crowd.
Yeah, the victim got involved with the wrong crowd, ultimately lost his life. And then the second point is, you know, from Christine's family's point of view, it not seeming as though police were all that interested, right, in trying to find out what happened to her. This is something that we have heard or seen in the research time and time again.
We do.
People levying the accusation against the police that because the victim is a sex worker or because the victim was a drug user, that they just weren't
a priority.
The police weren't all that interested in solving their murder. Now, is that true in all the cases where that accusation is levied? I'm sure it's not. Is it true in some? I believe it is.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a sad thing. We have both said on numerous occasions, it shouldn't make a difference what line of work the victim was in, whether they were in the grips of, let's say, a drug addiction. They were murdered.
Yeah.
And their murder should be treated as anyone else's.
They're a person.
They're a person. So that investigation should move forward. It should be given the care and the priority as anyone else's. I firmly believe that. And it kind of ticks me off when it's proven that that was not the case.
Right. Treat it less than.
4 months later, on May 22nd, 2007, the mother of 34-year-old Jackie Nakilia Thorpe reported her missing. It would be another 3 months before her severely decomposed body was found behind an abandoned house near the Seven Bridges Road on August 17th. Jackie was the first victim to be found near the infamous road, but her cause of death couldn't be determined. And Jackie couldn't be immediately identified due to the state of her remains.
That's something we keep hearing about, how the decomposition of the remains were in all these cases, it seems like, so far.
So we're going through the years, but the one thing I'm noticing is that a lot of the months we're talking about, May, June, okay, these are warm months in North Carolina.
Yeah.
And so obviously the rate of decomposition is going to be so much faster than it would be if we were talking about, you know, December, January, something like that.
Right.
Even in North Carolina. A few weeks after Jackie Thorpe went missing, 46-year-old Joyce Renee Durham also disappeared. She was last seen around 2:30 p.m. on Harper Street in Rocky Mount on June 17th. And we mentioned this earlier. Joyce Renee Durham is often considered a possible 12th victim of this serial killer. In February 2008, 50-year-old Ernestine Battle's sister reported her missing. According to GQ magazine, the mother of two had been in and out of the correction system for almost 10 years for drug and prostitution-related offenses. Ernestine was in the grip of drug addiction, but was still very close to her family, and she maintained contact with them. And this is something that I think kind of runs the gamut in the cases that we research. You have individuals who are addicted to drugs.
Sure.
Many of them don't have contact with their family. And therefore, when they do go missing, oftentimes people don't realize it.
No, because they're not staying in contact with anybody. So,
but that wasn't the case here. Ernestine had also lived close to the previous victim, Jackie Thorpe. As reported by the Rocky Mount Telegram, a month after Ernestine was last seen, a farmer found her skeletonized remains near the Seven Bridges Road. And Gibbs, this was pretty much the exact location where Jackie Thorpe had been found.
So it makes you feel like probably is a serial killer.
Well, it seems as though, and not to be callous, but it's a dumping ground,
right,
for a killer. Maybe because they're familiar with the area, they feel as though they know the traffic patterns well enough that they're not going to be spotted. It's kind of hard not to put these together when, you know, they're found along this same stretch of road. Some of the victims are found essentially in the same exact location. The coroner was unable to determine a cause of death at Ernestine's autopsy, given the severe state of decomposition.
Now, what I do find interesting is if it is a serial killer, which obviously we assume it is, he's not stuck on a certain age group. I mean, so far the victims range from 24 up to 50 years old.
Yeah, and I think that varies by killer, right? We have seen killers who have a type, and they kind of stick to that type when they're stalking, selecting their victims. And then we've seen killers who, maybe like this one, don't have an exact type as far as age. The age ranges span, you know, many, many years.
Yeah.
I don't know what that tells us about the killer. I don't know if it tells us anything. I just think that some killers are very rigid.
Yes.
When it comes to victim selection. Maybe some are not as rigid and are more opportunistic.
Yeah, I think you're spot on with that.
Well, I hope I am. On February 5th, 2009, a 37-year-old mother of two, Yolanda Renee Lancaster, went missing after a fight with her boyfriend. Nicknamed Snap, Yolanda started using drugs and alcohol in her teen years. She soon fell in with a rough crowd. She was arrested multiple times for petty offenses. At the time of her disappearance, she lived with her boyfriend in what was described in a number of different outlets as less than desirable housing conditions. And then just a week later, the nude body of a woman was found near a soccer field along Melton Drive in Rocky Mount. This was 33-year-old Elizabeth Jane Smallwood, and local police didn't even know that she had been missing. According to WRAL News, when investigators looked into Elizabeth's background, they discovered that she had very little contact with her family, so no one was really sure when she had been last seen.
So it kind of goes to what you said a little bit ago, right?
Yeah. We see it in so many different cases that sometimes when a victim is found, nobody even knows they're missing just because they have so little contact with maybe not just even their family, but really anyone.
Yeah, friends or it's kind of sad.
It is sad. Elizabeth had prior charges relating to prostitution, assault, drug possession, robbery, and resisting arrest. The medical examiner estimated Elizabeth's body could have remained where it was dumped anywhere from 6 months to a year. The cause of death was noted as undetermined. However, the autopsy revealed Elizabeth had likely died because of homicidal violence.
We've seen that a few times as well.
Yeah, they don't have enough information to make a conclusive ruling, but their best estimation is that they were murdered. All right, Gibbs, let's take a quick break. You know, some days can be a real struggle. The good news is I'm having a lot less of those since I found True Niagen. I love it. True Niagen helps fuel the cell's energy engines, maintains cellular metabolism, and even supports heart health in combination with a healthy lifestyle. With 13 published human clinical studies and backed by Nobel Prize winners, True Niagen is a supplement that's clinically proven to boost NAD levels, an essential coenzyme required for cellular energy and repair. Since taking True Niagen, I have more resiliency and it helps my muscles recover. I just have more zest for life. Add more vitality to your life today with True Niagen. Right now, new customers can save 10% on their first purchase by going to TrueNiagen.com/unsolved and use code unsolved. That's TrueNiagen.com/unsolved, code unsolved, to save 10% on your first purchase. TrueNiagen.com/unsolved, code unsolved. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. We talk about BetterHelp a lot on this show. And this month, we're discussing some of the stigmas around mental health. For example, some people think you should wait until things are unbearable to go to therapy. But that isn't true. Therapy is a tool to utilize before things get worse, and it can help you avoid those lows. And we've been taught that mental health shouldn't be a part of normal life. That's wrong, too. We take care of our bodies with the gym, the doctor, and nutrition. We should be focusing on our minds just as much. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can be matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. Give it a try and see why over 2 million people have used BetterHelp online therapy. And True Crime All the Time Unsolved listeners get 10% off their first month at BetterHelp.com/all the time. That's Better H-E-L-P. .com/all the time. So we've talked about a large number of African American women who disappeared, who were found murdered, or at the very least found dead, even if they couldn't determine that they were murdered. I think one of the things that was very clear from the research is that many of the families, if not all, of the families of the missing women did not feel as though the police had done enough or done very much to help or to investigate.
And that could have been a combination of the fact that they were sex workers or drug users and African-American.
Well, and to add on to that, there were no national news stories and really not much in the way of local airtime devoted to what was really an alarming trend. I mean, yeah, if you look at it, you would have to say that it was newsworthy, if that's the right way for me to say it. A large number of women have gone missing. A large number of women have been found dead in what?
A 13-mile stretch?
A 13-mile stretch in, you know, over a number of years. That should be alarming to anyone.
And you would think it would be something that, one, you'd want to make sure there was awareness about it for safety.
Sure.
And then secondly, to assist with the investigation.
And I'm thinking, you know, as a paper, as a television outlet, are you telling me that this is not a story that would make headlines, would grab people's attention, you know, let alone that you might be doing some good,
right,
by disseminating this information? You know, get down to the core of it. You know, newspapers are all about circulation.
Yeah.
Television is all about ratings.
Right.
That's why you see those teasers about, you know, something that's made to kind of grab your attention. To me, this is a story that would grab people's attention.
I would think so.
So what is the only logical conclusion that people can make from this, especially the victims' families? And it goes back to exactly what you said. These are African-American women, many of whom were known to have engaged in sex work and or drugs.
Yeah.
And so we don't want to air that story.
Which would be frustrating as a parent or family member of the victims.
Well, I can tell you right now, Gibbs, and you know, this is something that you and I don't bring into the conversation unless it's warranted, but where we live, if the number of individuals that we've already talked about so far, and we have more to talk about, had gone missing, had been found dead, and they were white females, that story would be on our news.
Oh, for sure.
There is no doubt in my mind.
Oh, absolutely.
And that is frustrating to me. On February 29th, 2009, the father of 29-year-old mother of one, Tara Shanice Nicholson, reported his daughter missing. According to the Winston-Salem Journal, Tara had a history of sex work, drug abuse, and jail time. GQ magazine reported that Tara and her boyfriend had been living with her father. But things became so strained, he eventually kicked the pair out. Tara and her boyfriend took to squatting in a house in an impoverished part of Rocky Mount. 2 weeks later, her body was found by hunters near Seven Bridges Road, a few miles north of town. According to court documents, Tara was nude except for socks and a bra, which was pulled up over her breasts. A purple bracelet, a black t-shirt, and black underwear were found near her body. Tara had sustained numerous injuries, including bruising, a fractured hyoid bone, a subdural hemorrhage, and scratches. Because she'd been lying in the woods for several days, it wasn't possible for the medical examiner to determine an exact time of death. What was determined was that Tara had been killed by strangulation.
With that bone broken in her neck, you can probably imagine that this strangulation was pretty forceful.
Just over 2 months later, 31-year-old sex worker Jarnice LaTanya Hargrove was reported missing by her family on May 2nd. Nicknamed Sunshine, Jarnice dropped out of school in her early teen years and was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. According to GQ magazine, in the years that followed, Jarnice often loved to write rap lyrics, but her addiction to drugs gradually took over. She was last seen after visiting her family to ask to borrow money. According to the Rocky Mount Telegram, a search was conducted in the local area, but there was no trace of Jarnice until 2 months later. Her badly beaten body was found in a wooded area about 180 yards away from Seven Bridges Road on June 29th. She was found nude, except for a few items of jewelry. WRAL News reported that the police didn't give out any information as to Jarnice's cause of death, but her mother told the outlet that the sheriff told her that Jarnice was likely strangled. And Gibbs, there were no further similar disappearances or murders for the remainder of 2009. All right, Gibbs, let's take a quick break to talk about Haichu. I'm not exaggerating. Haichu has changed my level of happiness. It makes me want to tell everybody about this candy. Haichu comes in over 200 flavors. It first launched in Japan in 1975. I love them all, mainly because the candy tastes like what it says it is. I think if I have to pick one, my favorite is the piña colada. And it has such a unique, chewy texture. It's not gum. It's not taffy. It's really unlike anything else. There's no artificial flavor taste at all. Piña colada tastes like piña colada. Mango tastes like mango. Haichu uses concentrated fruit juices and purees. So every time you put a piece of Haichu in your mouth, you experience an explosion of flavors. It's pretty simple. Haichu makes people happy, and happy people smile more. We want you to love Haichu as much as we do. Visit www.hi-chew.com/win. That's hichew.com/win. And enter to win an exclusive bucket full of Haichu candy and swag. While you're there, check out how you can become a member of the Haichu Chew Crew, which is an exclusive club where you receive special offers and all of the cool things. Go to hichew.com/win. The Associated Press reported on some of the things, Gibbs, that you and I kind of have already talked about, right? That these families felt that they were really kind of in a fight with law enforcement to get them to proactively investigate what had happened to their loved ones.
And isn't that a shame that you have to get law enforcement to be proactive?
And or a shame that you feel that way? Because again, I don't know what law enforcement was doing. What I do know is that the families felt as though they weren't doing what they should have been doing. So to me, that's a shame even to have to feel that way.
Sure. I don't know if that's a lack of communication or just a lack of investigation.
Right. And it could be a little bit of both. The other thing that came up in the research was that law enforcement hadn't even made any type of formal statement warning the community that a serial predator may be on the loose. And I can understand maybe not doing it after the first victim is found. Maybe even the second victim. But when you get, you know, 6, 7, 8 victims who are found within, you know, a span of not that long of a period of time.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe we need to put something out there. Now, there's a balance there, right? Between informing the public and inducing panic.
Right. But if you can find a way to get it out there, maybe, and it's a big maybe, you save somebody's life.
Yeah, you get somebody to come forward and say, hey, I know something about one of the murders or all of the murders. I know this was a point of contention with the families, that not only did they feel as though the police weren't doing their job investigating, they weren't even, you know, notifying the public. The families and friends of Jarnice Hargrove, Taryn Nicholson, Melody Wiggins, Ernestine Battle, and Jackie Thorpe felt so strongly about the need to advocate for their daughters and sisters that they established a community group called MOMS, which stood for Murdered or Missing Sisters. They organized billboards with photos of their loved ones to prompt the public to come forward. And this can work. We've seen this work in some cases.
You sure have.
Obviously, there's that movie, right? Three billboards outside of Ebbings, Missouri. It's been a while since I've seen that movie. From what I remember, I believe it's based on a true story, but we've seen where people have taken this route over the years.
Yeah, we've done a handful of stories where billboards were involved with helping the investigators to try to find who killed the victims.
Well, at the very least, it cannot hurt, right? If it brings in one tip.
Yeah.
Or it spurs one person to come forward and say, I might know something. You know, maybe that gives the police the lead that they need to go on.
Use every avenue that you can.
Now, another problem that's been brought up a lot in this case is that law enforcement didn't link the murder of the first victim, Denise Williams, and the third victim, Travis Harrison, with the other victims initially, despite all the similarities. Denise was not involved as a sex worker, but Travis had been. His body was found only a mile away from where Elizabeth Smallwood was discovered in early 2009. Investigators maintained that there was insufficient evidence to connect Denise and Travis's murders with the others. But Travis's mother felt that if he was dressed as a woman when he was murdered, this could have made him a target.
And we know they never found what he was dressed in. He just had his socks on at the time that they discovered his body. So I think she makes a good point.
Yeah, we talked about it. He was known to wear women's clothing. And I think you can make that argument that the attacker might have thought that Travis was a woman from the way that he was dressed and selected him as, you know, his next victim. Because you do kind of have to look at it as the outlier, right? Travis is the lone male. So if you're working off the theory that this is a serial killer, that all these murders are connected, you kind of have to explain Travis's murder in the series. And I do feel as though this is a good possible explanation.
Yeah.
So Gibbs, at this point, police have 11 unsolved murders or missing persons to investigate over a 6-year period. If just one killer was responsible, he'd been active for a considerable amount of time. He was most likely very skilled at preying upon his victims, killing them, and then dumping their bodies while avoiding detection.
Well, I think local investigators were having a tough time and were going to continue having a tough time finding this killer without some help.
According to the Winston-Salem Journal, the Edgecombe County Sheriff's Office formed a task force in June 2009 to consult with the State Bureau of Investigation and the FBI to help catch the killer. The investigators were able to link some of the victims together with the help of their families. According to profilers, there was a single killer who lived in or around the area, and he had targeted the victims. A reward totaling $20,000 was offered for information leading directly to an arrest and conviction or the discovery of the remaining victims. And I do think this is important, right? Number one, asking for help.
Sure.
I always think is important. And then, you know, once you get that help, you get the experts in on the case, you have profilers who come to the conclusion that this is a single killer. This is a serial killer who has murdered all of these victims. Because I think that's very important.
It is.
Right? Are we dealing with one killer or multiple killers? And this determination of a single killer is very important to the investigation. During the investigation, police also went back through their records to track down local men who they knew had a history of using sex workers. But no new leads surfaced out of this pool of potential persons of interest. The police eliminated anyone in the victim's immediate social circles as being involved in each murder, or whether any of the deaths were perhaps related to unpaid drug debts.
Well, so they're going through and checking the boxes, right? Making sure that everything's been covered.
Following the murder of Tara Nicholson, police were able to gather some DNA evidence. They found traces of semen on Tara's body at her autopsy. This was the breakthrough that investigators needed. The DNA was sent off to the lab, and when the results came back, there was a match. The DNA was identified as belonging to a man from Rocky Mount. He was 31-year-old Antoine Maurice Pittman. He had a lengthy criminal record for things such as drunk driving, theft, assault, resisting arrest, providing alcohol to minors, and the attempted rape of a child. At the time, he was living with his mother and girlfriend.
Sounds potentially dangerous.
Pittman was born in Rocky Mount on July 15th, 1978. He didn't know his father growing up. He was raised solely by his mom. From early childhood, he had learning disabilities. During his early teen years, Pittman lived with his grandparents in the rural community of Whitakers and attended high school in Tarboro. He often visited the Seven Bridges Road area, where the bodies of Tara Nicholson, Jackie Thorpe, Ernestine Battle, and Jarnice Hargrove were later found within a 10-mile radius. Pittman had a tough time keeping on the straight and narrow, and he became known to local police as a teen. His behavior escalated pretty quickly. He dropped out of high school in the ninth grade. When he was 16 years old, he was arrested for attempting to rape a 2-year-old child who lived nearby. That is sickening.
Very sick.
But Pittman struck a plea deal, pleading guilty to taking indecent liberties with the minor, which allowed him to be released on probation on a 3-year sentence.
And you know, that ticks me off.
It does. And again, we don't always know the details of these types of cases, right? What really did they have against him? Were some of the parties involved willing to testify? Obviously, probably the 2-year-old couldn't. So you just don't know. Maybe that plea deal was necessary.
Yeah. And he was 16 years old. So I'm assuming they took that into consideration as well.
Yeah, but it's still a very nasty, heinous crime. And even though he got off really on probation, there were strict conditions attached. He had to register as a sex offender. According to investigative reporter Mike Hixonbaugh, Pittman was required to spend 90 days in juvenile offender rehab, which was described, Gibbs, as kind of like a boot camp. But he was only a third of the way through his stay when he got into a fight. He was kicked out of the program and placed under house arrest with his mother as a result.
Sounds like he got the better end of that deal.
Well, depending on what he thought about this boot camp.
Yeah.
How bad is house arrest in your mom's house compared to jail?
Yeah.
Prison. Maybe what was a harsh boot camp. I don't know.
Hey, Ma, I want some lasagna.
Exactly. I mean, I don't know. It could have been the cushiest scenario possible for him.
Yeah.
All right, Gibbs, let's take our last break to talk about AirMed Care Network. You know, in all of the unsolved episodes that we do, we talk about a lot of unforeseen scenarios. So everyone listening knows that the unexpected does happen. If a medical emergency arises, an AirMed Care Network membership protects your family. It also protects your finances. AirMed Care Network crews provide air medical transport to the nearest and most appropriate trauma center. And as a member, you'll never see a bill for that flight. That's right. Members never pay a dime for transport when flown by an AMCN provider. Health insurance may not cover the full cost of emergency medical air transport, so this is a very important membership to have. It covers everyone in your household for just pennies a day. And right now, True Crime All the Time Unsolved listeners get up to a $50 Amazon or Visa e-gift card when you join. So be prepared with an AirMed Care Network membership. Visit airmedcarenetwork.com/true and use offer code TRUE. In early 1996, at the age of 17, Pittman was arrested for parole violations, resulting in an 18-month stay in a Morganton juvenile detention facility. When he was in his mid-20s, he did another 45 days in county jail and had to provide a blood sample as a result of applying for a job but failing to disclose his sex offender status. Following his release, Pittman drifted from job to job. In 2003, he was 24 years old and he moved to Rocky Mount, where he lived for the next 6 years on the edge of town, pretty close to Seven Bridges Road. And it was over this same six-year period, Gibbs, that African Americans started to disappear from Edgecombe County, only to turn up murder. Can you make a connection there? Sure. Oh, obviously you can. Can you say that it's a smoking gun or it conclusively means he's the killer? No, you can't. It could be a coincidence, but man, it's not the type of coincidence that you would ever want to be associated with.
And it's just going to look even more worse for him as we move on.
At one point during 2005, Pittman was found to have lived close to the soccer field where Elizabeth Smallwood's body was later found dumped in February 2009. So, I mean, I think based on things like that, you can definitely make the argument that Pittman was very familiar with the area.
Yeah, had the knowledge.
Had the knowledge, back kind of to what I was talking about before, maybe the traffic patterns, the time of day where it was very unlikely that someone would be coming along at this location, things like that.
Yeah.
In 2006, at the age of 27, Pittman moved again, this time into a trailer in the town of Scotland Neck in Halifax County. He continued to rack up more convictions for drunk driving, soliciting, and assaulting a sex worker.
Well, he wasn't a pillar of the community, was he?
No, he absolutely wasn't. I sure would not have wanted him living next to me. The thing that jumps out at me here, though, is soliciting and assaulting a sex worker. Okay, we know he was in the area. We know he was very familiar with the area. Now he has a connection with sex workers.
Yeah, and being violent with them.
On April 25th, 2009, the same day that Jarnese Hargrove disappeared, Pittman was found by North Carolina Highway Patrol officers on Seven Bridges Road. He was in his car and was asleep with his pants unzipped and was wearing muddy boots.
That's not a good way to be found.
No, it sounds like a Thursday night for you, but for most people, that is out of the ordinary. You know, I don't sit around in my car with my pants unzipped, first of all. That's number one.
Yeah.
And then the muddy boots. Okay, could you have been out hiking, bird watching? Sure. Could you also have been disposing of a body in an area that was muddy and you brought your boots along because you knew you'd be there?
Sure could have.
And then next, explain to me why your pants are unzipped.
Why mine are right now, or are you talking about why his were?
No, his.
Yeah.
You know, that line from Something About Mary, you know, we're all just peeing, is not going to work here in this situation.
No, it's not.
Officers woke him up to find out what was going on, and they ended up charging him with drunk driving. According to reporter Mike Hixonbaugh, when Pittman later failed to appear in court, he was listed as a fugitive, but he wasn't on the run for very long. He was arrested on traffic offenses a few months later in nearby Nash County. And by this time, Jarnese's body had been found, not far away from where Pittman was arrested wearing the muddy boots. Investigators working on the string of murders had also sent away the semen sample found on Tara Nicholson's body for testing, and they compared it with Pittman's DNA. They found that it was a match. So a month after his arrest for failing to appear in court, 31-year-old Pittman was charged with the first-degree murder of Tara Nicholson. His mother and neighbors told the Winston-Salem Journal and ABC 11 News that they were shocked at the arrest, claiming he was a quiet guy who kept to himself. Okay, he might have been, but to be honest with you, Gibbs, sometimes those people scare me the most. Now, I'm also a quiet guy who keeps to myself, so.
Point made.
Point taken. When investigators looked into Antoine's background further, it appeared as though he could be responsible for the murders of at least eight of the other victims. Now, they didn't have concrete evidence, right, to prove that. But just looking at circumstantial evidence, they felt it was possible. The FBI profiler had advised only 2 months before Pittman's arrest that the killer would be living in close proximity to where the bodies were found and would not stop killing. And we talk about profilers a lot. You know, I know there's a lot of things that go into it. Sometimes I joke about how I could have come up with a profile.
Right. Common sense.
There is sometimes a lot of common sense. But I do think the would not stop killing part is probably in a lot of profiles.
Sure.
Especially if you're talking about a serial killer who you believe has been operating over, let's say, a 6-year period. Okay, there's no reason for that person to stop on their own. And to me, that's just kind of common sense.
Yeah, I mean, clearly at this point, he hadn't stopped, so why would he?
And my assumption is the living in proximity has to do with the familiarity that we talked about, you know, regarding this Seven Bridges Road area, being able to dump bodies, get away without being seen, things like that.
And where to locate his victims.
Yeah, I think that would go into it as well. On March 5th, 2010, Christine Boone's skeletonized remains were located in a wooded area in Scotland Neck, not far from the site where Pittman had lived in his trailer during 2006. It was more than 3 years after Christine had been initially reported missing, and authorities executed a search warrant at the site. According to WRAL News, the search revealed pornography on Pittman's computer depicting women being raped. Pittman's computer was also used to access other websites containing what was called rape-type content. According to ABC 11 News, less than 3 weeks later, another woman's body was found off Seven Bridges Road between Brattleboro and Whitaker's by a man riding an ATV. The woman was identified as a 40-year-old mother of three, Roberta Williams. When police spoke with her family, they were concerned to learn Roberta had supposedly been reported as missing by her relatives, but there was nothing in police files to indicate that any such report had been taken. But according to WRAL News, there's a different story. One of Roberta's relatives claimed they'd last seen her in the spring of 2008, saying she hadn't been reported missing because she had been homeless.
Well, I think for her family, though, they assumed she was reported missing. So to find out that there was never a report on file, this had to be disappointing to them and frustrating.
Yeah, I think two good adjectives. In 2010, Antoine Pittman was still waiting trial, but the discovery of Roberta's body prompted the National Guard to be called in to help in a large-scale search for any other missing women. But no other bodies were found at that time. The body count finally stopped in January 2011, after the last known victim was found. According to ABC 11 News, a group of hunters making their way through a wooded area off Seven Bridges Road looking for deer antlers discovered the decomposed body of Yolanda Lancaster, who'd last been seen almost 2 years earlier. After several delays, Pittman finally went to trial in September 2011. Mothers of several of the other victims accompanied Tara Nicholson's mother to support her. Unfortunately, prosecutors couldn't put together sufficient evidence against Pittman to charge him with the murder of the other 8 victims. According to WRAL News, prosecutors announced they would not seek the death penalty due to a lack of aggravating factors to meet the threshold for a capital crime. Pittman pleaded not guilty, but his strategy came undone during proceedings when it emerged that he'd had contact with Tara before she disappeared. Pittman told the court that on March 1st, 2009, Tara willingly got into his vehicle. The two then drove to a hotel where he paid her $20 for sex, which explained the presence of his semen on her body. Pittman claimed he last saw Tara when he dropped her off at the Rocky Mount Library. But the court heard from forensic experts who testified that, based on the autopsy evidence, Tara died less than 24 hours after having sex with Pittman. Two sex workers testified for the prosecution, claiming they'd each had separate encounters with Pittman. He drove them to a secluded location outside of town. Then he attempted to strangle both women. Thankfully, they both escaped with their lives, but Pittman claimed he'd never seen these women before. Now, the jury didn't buy his story that he didn't know what happened to Tara after their encounter. He was found guilty and sentenced to life in prison with no parole.
He certainly had the ability to kill.
Yeah. Well, jury concluded that he right. did. You know, if you take the testimony of, you know, some of these other women who said they had encounters with him, he tried to strangle them. We know that some of these victims died by strangulation. We also know that some of their causes of death couldn't be conclusively identified. So could they have all been strangled? Could the killer's MO have been strangulation?
Sure.
Yeah. So I'm sure detectives, law enforcement, the prosecution, they were happy to secure a conviction against Pittman for Tara's murder. But Gibbs, it had to have been a little bit bittersweet, right? Because there remained the matter of the other victims who had been found dead. And then you had Joyce Durham, who was still missing. In late 2012, Pittman appealed his conviction, but it was dismissed in mid-2013. So you mentioned it, Gibbs. Pittman had the ability to kill, right? That was proven in court. He was in the area when all of these murders were committed. He had intimate knowledge of the area. He was known to have paid for sex.
Yeah.
So there's a connection there to sex workers.
You know, he liked to strangle.
We do know that he was a strangler. So there is a real possibility that he committed these other murders. We said it, right? The prosecutors couldn't put together the evidence to charge him with any of these other murders. So because of that, I think we have to look at some other theories, as though Pittman was not the serial killer responsible for the other murders. There are a couple of competing theories as to the killer's identity. One theory is that some of the women were victims of domestic abuse, trapped without a way out. We know that Yolanda Lancaster fought with her boyfriend before she went missing. Melody Wiggins' boyfriend had a prior charge for assaulting her, but he has a strong alibi for her murder. He was in jail at that time. And then I think the other theory is that another killer was operating in the same area at the same time with the same victimology. And Gibbs, I don't think this is outside the realm of possibility. I mean, how many cases have we researched where it's ultimately come out that there were two, three, sometimes even more serial killers operating in the same general area at the same time?
Oh yeah. We've had many occasions where they overlapped.
That's scary.
It is scary.
I think, you know, for a long time, it was thought by many criminologists and profilers that serial killers either didn't or just couldn't stop killing once they started. I think it's now thought of that that's not exactly a hard and fast rule. I still think the majority kind of operate that way, that they don't just decide to stop, but we know that it happens, right? You look at people like Dennis Rader, BTK. He killed 10 people over the course of 17 years in Kansas. And then look at, you know, EAR, the original Night Stalker, the Golden State Killer, Joseph D'Angelo, who terrorized California, killing 13 people and raping 50 women over a 12-year period before suddenly stopping and lying low for the next 32 years. So, you know, obviously it's theoretically possible for someone to engage in serial murder, serial rape, and then right. stop for whatever reason. So that makes it possible, right? That this killer is still out there, maybe keeping a low profile after having seen what happened to Antoine Pittman.
Yeah. Or moved on to another area.
And that's a definite possibility as well. You know, this person could have been ecstatic that Antoine Pittman was convicted, that I think most people believe that he's responsible for a large number of the other murders. And so, okay, you know what? It's now time for me to move on. He could be operating in another area of the country. So Gibbs, as we wrap up this episode, I think many people believe that the man responsible for these murders, if not all of them, maybe most of them, is already behind bars.
And I guess the most compelling piece of evidence to support this theory is that once Pittman was in custody, the disappearances and the murders stopped.
And that could be very telling. It also could support the other killer theory.
Sure.
Right? We just said maybe another killer was happy that they'd pinned the one murder on Pittman and said, you know what, I'm getting out of here. So yeah.
I'm going to take this get out of free jail card and go.
It's get out of jail free. You said get out of free jail card.
That's how I play it.
Okay. So you have a different Monopoly set than the rest of us?
I couldn't really afford the real one, so we had to do it by
hand. You just wrote it by hand?
Yeah.
But to me, I think what's very telling is that, you know, when you look at the reporting on this case, the official line from law enforcement is that Pittman is believed to be responsible for the other murders. So I think that's very telling. They don't have the evidence to do anything about it yet.
Right.
Or at this point in time, but it sounds like they're pretty sure. And I can see why they would be. For all the reasons that we've talked about.
Yeah.
In 2016, the victim's family spoke to the Associated Press about their ongoing pain and suffering. They feel that now Pittman is behind bars, their sisters, daughters, and friends have long been forgotten. And I get it, Gibbs. That is tough, right? There's only one family,
right,
who really got justice. And that's the family of Tara Nicholson. The other families may believe that Pittman was responsible for their loved ones' murders.
Right.
But until it's proven, they're still going to struggle with that. Yeah. There's no finality in it. And that has to be tough for any family member of a victim.
Yeah, we always want that finality.
If you have any information on the murders of Denise Williams, Melody Wiggins, Travis Harrison, Christine Boone, Jackie Thorpe, Joyce Durham, Ernestine Battle, Yolanda Lancaster, Elizabeth Smallwood, or Jarnice Hargrove, you can contact the Edgecombe County Sheriff's Office at 252-641-7911 or Twin County Crime Stoppers at 252-977-1111. All right, Gibbs, that is it for our episode on the Edgecombe County serial killer. We got some voicemails. You want to check those out?
Yeah, let's hear them.
Hey, guys. My name is Franny. I'm outside of Billings, Montana. And, Fergie, this is for you. Who is Team Jacob? Because I love both of you guys equally, so I'm Team Jacob. I just want to say I love you guys. You're awesome. I work at the post office, and right now we're doing 6 12-hour days. So I am flying through your episodes. Just signed up for Patreon because I need more. I've listened to True Crime All the Time and Unsolved. But a case suggestion, Kyron Horman outside of Portland, he disappeared, I want to say, like 2011, and he's a young kid. I don't know a lot of info. I just remember seeing the billboards on I-5. So interesting case, like kind of remember bits and pieces of it, but I'd love to hear your guys' take on it and keep it going. You guys are awesome. Thanks. Bye.
Well, thank you. We appreciate you signing up for Patreon. The Kyron Horman case is a big one.
Yeah, I have worked on that in the past, and it's just such a huge case.
It is. I know we'll do it. Yeah. It's been on the list. I don't know when we'll do it. As far as Team Jacob, I'm assuming that's Twilight, right? There's Edward. Wasn't there a guy named... I remember back in the day, people were Team this, and one was Robert Pattinson, and the other was the Taylor Lautner. Is he Jacob?
I have no idea. You watch that stuff, not me.
I actually did watch the Twilight movies with my wife. Did not enjoy them. I know that's going to upset some fans of Twilight. They were not my thing.
I'm thinking maybe it was like a Office episode reference or something.
I think it was Twilight, but that's what I'm going with. Final answer.
Hi, Mike and Gibby. It's Ashton calling from Indianapolis, Indiana. I've listened to you all for over 3 years and tell just about everyone I know how incredible you all are. Just the kindness and grace you all have for the victims of these cases and the level of just overall research and digging into the trueness and the realness of each case you cover is unlike any other podcast I've seen and heard. So just really love you guys. I am Team Mike and Gibby. However, Team Mike has me a little bit more in their corner for one reason only. I'm also a huge UK Wildcat fan. So go Big Blue, stay safe, and keep your own time ticking. Thanks, guys.
Go Big Blue.
Have to. You have to. I'm so excited. I get excited during basketball season.
I do wish you guys the best.
But I will say I appreciate all the nice things that she said, definitely. Makes us feel good.
It does.
And that word of mouth is huge. You and I don't talk about it probably as much as we should, but word of mouth is a big deal for the podcast.
We appreciate that.
Hey, how's it going? This is Thomas from Lakeland again. Over the weekend was my birthday and my son's birthday, and I felt like it was the right time to go ahead and become a Patreon member because I finished all the TCAD unsolved. So I appreciate y'all so. Y'all get me through my work day. I'm always eager when it comes in on Monday morning to come start listening to your new stuff. And I'm actually Team Fergie. It ain't the same without, you know, Gibby, but Team Fergie and me have a, you know, me and Fergie have a lot more in common. And I really, you know, think he's on his game all the time. Take care and keep your on time ticking.
Wait, does that mean I'm not on my game all the time?
I'm taking it to mean that. No. So, okay, we got a couple of Team Fergies here, which is not the norm. Normally, there's way more Team Gibby. I'm fine with that. But, hey, it's nice to have a little Team Fergie every now and then.
We got to go into the Christmas holiday feeling a little down.
I will say happy birthday to both of you.
Yeah.
Belated.
But, happy birthday.
Yeah.
Hey, T-Cat. This is Luke. A long-time listener, first-time caller. I was just listening to the Ronald Ward episode, and I just wanted to comment. I'm a 90s baby and went to elementary school in North Carolina, and we just so happened to have a paddle in the principal's office. I think I'm the last of a generation of people knowing what it's like for unusual punishment, I guess, but thank you guys. You guys are an inspiration. I love listening to your podcast, and I guess I'm Team Gibby, and that's all. Keep your own time ticking.
Hey, who doesn't like a little paddling?
Okay. Hey, what you do in your personal life? How many times do I have to tell you this?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry.
I don't care what you do in your personal life.
Yeah.
No. So, all right. Pendulum swings back to Team Gibby, which is awesome. But, you know, that was obviously a TCAD episode.
Right.
We don't have a TCAD episode this week, so I played the voicemail on Unsolved. But it is interesting, depending on how old you are, you know, listening to the show, whether you get, you know, certain references. It's just like us being of a certain age, we're not going to get newer references.
Right.
I just don't know what some of this stuff means, but I sure know and remember what it was like to walk into the principal's office and see that paddle. Yep. There was a little bit of fear that was induced at that point in time.
I was in a bar the other night and,
you said day night. It was a long bar session.
But they, you know, they do those flights. Well, mm-hmm. A lot of these flights boards remind me of the paddle. They had that
like handle. They would make a good paddle.
Yeah. The little holes in for the little sample cups.
Yep.
Or the flights.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
And you know that.
Don't do a lot of flights nowadays, but sounds like you're doing them day and night, which is good.
Yeah. So next time
I'm happy for you.
Yeah. Next time you see one of those flight boards, bend over and take a few.
Think about getting a paddling.
Yeah.
All right, buddy. That is it for another episode of True Crime All the Time Unsolved. So for Mike
and Gibby,
stay safe and keep your own time ticking.